Telecast.
Hi, I'm Justin Crosby, and welcome to another Telecast. On this week's show, I meet Banerjee Wright's LA-based EVP of Sales, Co-Productions and Acquisitions, Matt Creasy, ahead of a big week at MIPCOM. And from Rome at the MIA market, I sit down with Beer Hegedus, Executive Managing Director of Vice Distribution. It's all coming up on this week's Telecast. My first guest on this week's Telecast as we head into MIPCOM week is Matt Creasy, EVP of Sales, Co-Productions and Acquisitions at Banerjee Wright. Welcome to Telecast, Matt.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate being invited on.
Not at all. Great to be with you. And you're speaking to me from London, I think, at the moment, which is not your usual location. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm speaking to you from the glamorous Key West Hotel in Shepherd's Bush, which is next door to the Banerjee offices, which has been my sort of kind of second home for the last 14 years when I travel backwards and forwards from LA to London to be in the office. So, yeah, I've been over here for a little bit of time and will be until the end of MIPCOM.
That's a regular sort of thing, is it, for you on your way into MIPCOM? There's a stop off in London for a week or so to, you know, get things prepared and do the meetings that you need to before you head over to Cannes?
Yeah, it's a combination of reasons, really. Part of my role out in the US is working very closely with, obviously, our teams here in London and including all of our producers as well. So it's an opportunity to spend time with our producers just on general business and just catching up face to face. There's also, because I am not in the office every week in London, it's a good opportunity for the senior management team to get together separately and just talk face to face and prepare just in general about the business. So it's a combination of reasons. And I always like to come in much, much earlier as well, just because there's a lot for me to do in London before I even get to Cannes in the first place. I mean, Cannes almost like just at the end of it. London's almost as important in a way.
And there's a lot of producers to catch up with, isn't there? You've got
well, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. So we are working very closely with our producers, both scripted and unscripted. We invest in a lot of production, and the UK producers are very focused on what we can do in the US. So it's important I see them face to face.
Well, I know the Key West very well. I had a pre-wedding night event there with all my family and friends, and bizarrely, everybody that was on Top of the Pops, as it was back then, all piled in, and it was the most bizarre evening I've ever had with Vic and Bob and all sorts of people sat next to my dad, which is very bizarre, but yeah.
Those days are somewhat faded. I think you're more likely to be sitting next to a double glazing convention that's down in Olympia. So it's not quite what it used to be, I don't think, but it serves its purpose.
So you're over from LA, but you're obviously an Englishman, or my assumption is you're an Englishman. Tell us about your career so far and what's led you to your position of EVP Sales, Co-Productions and Acquisitions.
Just sort of quick potted history. So I started in the business in 96, where I went in as a runner for a company back then called Portman Productions, which was a drama producer and a sort of a mini series producer doing the sort of Channel 4 Woman of Substance and Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca, those type of shows. So I went in as a runner back then, and that took me into working in development for a little bit. And then actually from there, I sort of then bounced across into distribution. So I've worked through various distribution companies in the UK. And I suppose it's that those stepping stones as you try to sort of get to your next stage in terms of the territories that you handle and wanting to sort of move up the ladder. So I worked for a sort of a handful of companies ranging from RM Associates, which was arts, documentaries and concerts, through to companies like Minotaur, which were part of Flextech. And so all of those channels at the time, like Living TV and sort of working in those type of programming. But the sort of the big, I suppose, break for me was when I got a job at Celador in the early 2000s, which was just beginning to really rise up to the level that it was for a few years because of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Of course.
And I worked on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire for 3 years and sort of traveled around the world and helped set it up and sell it. And it was an incredibly exciting time in terms of just watching a show explode. And still to this day, I think it's one of the most incredible formats ever made. And what it did at the time was really changed the industry, along with certain other shows at the time, like Survivor and Big Brother, which ironically I now work with as well. So, but that was the interesting break for me that then led me on to what was then Endemol in the mid-2000s, when Endemol didn't actually have a distribution arm at all. They were just really had the model there had been to work with producers in local territories that they wanted to work on shows like Big Brother. And in return for those sort of first looks, Endemol took shares in those companies and took positions in those companies, which led to the really early stages as to how Endemol grew so quickly across so many multiple territories. So we set up, myself and someone else called Caroline Torrance, we sort of set up the distribution arm there. And it's not a business that Endemol had ever thought about before. I mean, they'd had shows like Extreme Makeover Home Edition, Fear Factor, Deal or No Deal, all these type of shows which had just never really been sold anywhere before. So we sort of set up a small business with a small team, and it grew really, really quickly. And there was various changes of management at the senior level at Endemol over those years, and it led to someone called Enon Kreitz coming in, who's now, you'll be, I'm sure, familiar with, is the guy who now runs Mattel and really maybe the driving force behind Barbie recently. But he came in and he really saw the opportunity of how do I supersize distribution. And with that, he bought Southern Star Production, which we were already a partner in. But along with that, then said, well, I'd like to take Southern Star International as well. And that brought Southern Star distribution arm into Endemol and created Endemol Worldwide Distribution. And that's when Kathy Payne came in at that time, around 2008, 2009. The idea was, okay, well, let's supersize this. We need offices all around the world to have sort of local knowledge, local expertise sitting alongside our producers, and really taking the distribution business outside of London and, you know, really getting beyond the ground. So with that, Kathy came to me and said, look, I'm really interested in you coming to LA, setting it up in LA and working with all our production companies there, but also setting up offices in Singapore. And then we were in Mumbai and Miami, and then overseeing the Sydney distribution office that used to be the Southern Star one, which had sort of moved around slightly. So the role to move over there was sort of kind of twofold. It was to really launch a distribution business in the US that we never had before. And the business then actually was quite small, but also then to really drive the offices and the distribution offices outside of EMEA at that time. So I moved in January 2010. So that's the sort of what took me to LA. And that was sort of the potted history of very quickly over my career that took me to that. And then over the last 14 years, the company has changed in many ways, and actually ownership over a few times, actually, which means that it's always felt like almost new companies all the time. So it hasn't really sort of ever sat still. So I feel like I've worked for, I don't know, six companies within Endemol and all the time I've been here, really, even though I'm still in the same company, if you know what I mean. So yeah, that's a very quick history as to what took me to LA.
A story of almost being on this rapidly expanding business all the way through. And you talked about Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which was an absolute phenomenon back there, and you know, still is to a certain extent. When you worked on Millionaire, what was it that you've learned, you think, from that experience that you take into your role now? Because it was, you know, the first of its kind in many ways in terms of that sort of international format. That must have been an amazing experience. Is there anything in particular that, you know, you look back at that experience and you've learned and applied to your subsequent career?
Yeah, lots. Huge amount. I'm really indebted to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and Celador, because from a simple selfish reason, Endemol wouldn't have looked at me if I hadn't worked on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, because it just raised the profile. And what was not strange per se, but actually Endemol was the producer of Millionaire in many territories, because the model at Celador was to sell the format to producers or broadcasters as opposed to going setting up production companies in those territories. So the recipient a lot of the time at the other end of the format was Endemol. So in Germany and Italy, I think they even produce it still to this day in some of those territories. So it opened doors for me. But from a just an experience point of view, it's quite multifaceted. To this day, I still apply principles in my own head that I learned back then, because the format business, being the huge business that it is now globally, the principles are still the same. You know, the principle of a format is still the same. So I think being there at what was really genuinely the explosion of the format business at that time, a millionaire was the leader of it. It really taught me about what it takes for the expertise of how to get these shows made, and how discipline on unscripted formats is vital to longevity of formats. So it's kind of a famous story now, but you know, Paul Smith, who was one of the originators of Millionaire, along with the creators, I think they did maybe 11, 12 pilots for ITV, and each time it wasn't quite right. And it came down to the light bulb would change. We need to shine the light slightly that way. And how do we do this with the technical side? So that level of detail, I think, to this day is vital. And actually, when you took Millionaire all around the world, we were very, very strict about how the show had to be made, because we knew that's what made it work. So I think the principles of how to execute a format, that basis for me will stay with me for the business forever. And I think it's very important. The more sort of emotional side of Millionaire, which again, I think is vital across all entertainment. And you know, you see it in drama all the time, but also what people maybe forget with unscripted is that it's still a journey. It's still a story. And even though Millionaire is a game show, Millionaire's appeal was its simplicity of 15 questions, the possibility of winning £1 million. You know, that was the brilliance of the simplicity of it. And you feeling like you've achieved it because your intelligence has answered it, but it's not in a superior intellectual way. It was the man or the woman on the street could answer the question the same as a professor could, and actually maybe they could get further than the professor. So there was a great equality of it, which was brilliant. But really what it was every contestant had a story. And what was the story? Why were they on the show? And there was just these amazing stories of people going, you know, I wanted to pay for my children's education, or it's an opportunity for my daughters. But whatever it was, there was always a story as to why that contestant was on the show and why they wanted to win. So it wasn't just so, I just want to win money. There was a reason always behind it. And so you saw these incredible stories of people where the audience at home were both playing along, because you can't help but play along, but also willing, you know, you have a favorite contestant, you're like, oh, come on, you've got to do it. And then the disappointment when someone doesn't do it, but then the joy of when someone did. And I think it really taught me that, oh, wow, these shows are way beyond just a simple quiz show where, well done, you've got that question right and move on. It just created that so much. And that, to me, exploded into every type of show ever since. I mean, you look at all the, back then, the idols and then the talents and all those sort of things, they're all built on the same principle. What's your story? What's the story behind you being here? And I think that's the sort of the nub of what entertainment is. You know, I think people sometimes forget that. It's to bring people on an emotional journey and give them a real buzz while they're watching it. And Millionaire nailed that. I mean, you just look at some of the $1 million or £1 million winners over the years. I mean, the most famous one that comes to mind. It's really interesting you asked me about Millionaire. Obviously, I mean, I haven't worked on it for since 2003, 2004, but I'm very passionate about it still. One of the great ones in the US was the young man in his 20s. He was a smart guy, but you know, answering these amazing questions. And he had his lifeline on the $1 million question, which was, I think, phone a friend. And he phones his dad, and Regis Philbin reads the question to the dad. So this is the question. And he says, Dad, I don't need you to answer it. I'm just ringing you to tell you I'm about to win $1 million. You know, and the place, it's just a piece of brilliance that cannot be scripted, cannot be created. That was created by that contestant. And that was just such a wow moment. But there was many of those. So that's why it just made me really understand and love that you've got to, okay, I'm going to be very cliched here, but the magic of TV was encapsulated there. And then we've seen it many, many times since on many, many shows. I mean, I could sit here for hours and talk about shows where you've seen these emotional journeys and it was innocent as well. It didn't feel like you could see the strings, because there weren't strings behind the scenes of maybe manipulating the audience, which maybe you have to be careful of these days, where you maybe see that sometimes a bit more. There's a manipulation. But back then, it was honest and really innocent.
That's really interesting. It sounds like, am I right in saying that you're still sort of chasing those sort of magic moments with the formats that you're working with now, and always on the lookout to discover and build those formats with that same sort of connection of the you know, the human condition?
Yeah, I mean, we at Banerjee, we're very lucky to have some of the biggest formats in history, and all our creatives around the world who are developing and creating shows all the time. And it's the nub of the company is creativity. And I know that's a, sounds like a sort of, I'm reading from a corporate hymn sheet, but it's genuinely true. It's the creativity and finding those moments in TV is something which I've seen from the early days of Endemol all the way through to where we are now, Banerjee. We have it, you know, those big moments on Survivor, those emotional moments on Big Brother, you know, the winner on Deal or No Deal, it just happens all the time, and it's something which we all strive for creatively, you know. And I'm lucky to, I'm not a creative per se myself, so I'm happy, I'm very lucky to work alongside brilliant people who create these moments. But as a distributor, it's elevating you as distributor, and this is formats, finished programs, script, whatever it is, it elevates your pitch and your role of, we're all selling, basically, from the producer who's selling the idea and originally to the distributor selling it. We're all selling, and to sell, you need that enthusiasm and that utter passion behind of what makes a show tick. So it all goes into the same melting pot in the end.
Let's talk about Banerjee and your role there. It's a fairly wide encompassing role, isn't it? Sales, co-productions, yeah, and acquisitions. It's a big gig.
Yeah. I sit on the senior management team on Banerjee, and within that senior management team, we've got a small group, and we are looking at both outward and inward. So it's the acquisitions part is I work very closely with our EVP of acquisitions and our CEO and my peer who runs Europe as well. So we are analyzing and working both with our internal producers and third-party producers all the time in terms of investments and bringing content into the group. So that is both scripted and unscripted, but really in terms of the heavy investment, that is on the scripted side. So that's the acquisitions hat that I wear. So every decision that we make on what we invest in, I sit on that group that makes those decisions. On the sales, oversee our distribution team outside of EMEA. So I'm in charge of all the finished program distribution and the format distribution where we don't have producers, of all of my team as well. So I oversee that. And then in the US specifically, I have a team in the US and we oversee all the AVOD business, all the distribution business. So I have a team who's doing those areas of the business. So I oversee that. And then my specific role that I sort of handle for the whole of Banerjee is the co-production role, which is I sort of oversee the co-productions in the US, which is really the main co-productions we do globally, for scripted, some unscripted, but it's majority scripted. So that is us bringing projects in at script stage, maybe rough cut stage. We bring projects in at various stages, finding partners for shows that we have either invested in already, so we deficit finance it, and then therefore we need a partner to come in to offset our deficit, which will always be out of the US predominantly, or bringing projects in that just need funding from the US in order for us to get it green light, that the budget's so big that we need a partner to even get the show to kick off. So that's me working with, over the years, everybody from Netflix to Amazon to MGM Plus to Hulu to BBC to BritBox to Acorn, PBS, you name it, we've kind of worked on projects across the board. And that's obviously a very key area for us as a business in distribution, because the investments on drama can be quite
eye-watering,
scary, and any investment we're putting in there, we need to find a partner to really help us recoup in terms of our deficit financing. And that predominantly comes from the US.
And talking about scripted and investing into scripted, I'm going to put you on the spot here. In terms of a scripted project over the last 5 years or so, or in fact, since your time in this role, is there one particular project that you're particularly proud of when it comes to, you know, not only the success commercially, but also critically as well? Is there one drama project that stands out for you in something that you were really glad to be involved with?
There's several, but actually I'll give you a recent one. It does illustrate what you're asking. So we have a partnership through our production company Kudos with Steve Knight, the creator of Peaky Blinders, amongst many, many, many other films and TV shows, a very prolific man. And they had a commission with the BBC for SAS Rogue Heroes, which looks at back at the formation of the SAS in World War II, based on the Ben McIntyre book. This was a big, big series. I mean, £5 million plus budget, an episode, and you know, it's a very significant series. But a period drama set in World War II at a time when maybe that wasn't where the US market really was, not at all, I would even say. So it was a project that we needed to find a partner in. BBC had committed, and we had committed as well, but really was important for us to find it. And we did. We found a partner in MGM Plus who've been fabulous partners on that show. And then actually globally, we found fabulous partners everywhere. And it's proved an unbelievable success, both critically and commercially as well. And, you know, that took a lot of work. And, you know, there's always an element of luck in these situations. So I'll pull that in as well. We found the right partner, and that show's been a big success for us. So very proud to have worked on that. Kudos are amazing producers and produced an amazing show there, with Martin Haynes and Karen Wilson at the top there, and Steve is a wonderful man and an amazing writer as well, with all that cast. So all of that in a sort of putting it all together, that's been a really proud moment in the last few years for sure, especially in a market in America where on paper you would think, oh, this is going to be a challenging one, but you never know. And what it actually taught me as well was, I always, always, always keep the most open mind I possibly can on projects, even with sort of, I would argue, my expertise of knowing, well, that show's just not going to work for that network, or we shouldn't pitch it there, etc. That still applies, of course, but to always, always, always to keep an open mind on dramas, because what you perceive in your head of, well, I just don't see how that would sell, you're always proved wrong or sort of made to look a bit of a fool in those situations. And it's happened to me many, many times in the US. Even when I sold Black Mirror, actually, originally back in 2010-11, when I first moved to the US. And I remember, you know, just selling those first few episodes of Black Mirror in the US. Now, obviously, the history now, I mean, obviously it went on to be a massive hit with Netflix as an original. But the first seeds of that were selling the actual UK show, Channel 4 show, to DirecTV in the US. And of course, I pitched it to everyone. Everyone was like, there's no way we're ever going to show this show. You know, they couldn't get. But I was so passionate about Black Mirror, and I sold it to someone on a sofa at Nappy in Vegas, someone called Christy Felton, and she picked it up. And from that, Netflix sort of looked at it, and when they then picked up the further British episodes, and then actually then it became a massive thing for original production to see how that could be picked up, which was done. You know, obviously, I didn't do that part. That was done by producers. But that was another classic example of no one wanted to touch it, but you still got it away. And I'd add maybe a third more general one in terms of that. It was that when I first arrived in the US, and generally British drama was on Masterpiece Theatre, PBS, and BBC America. And pretty much everyone I would go and see at that time, They were just nonplussed as to why would we ever want to come in on a British show or an Australian show. We don't understand the accents. It just doesn't really work over here. I mean, doors were just shut in my face the whole time. And 3-4 years later, the world had changed. So I'm quite proud of being there at the very earliest times when people said no, basically.
I think that the strength of the projects that you're talking about, particularly SAS Rogue Heroes, was the way it was produced. It's not just the story, but actually the soundtrack was something that elevated it into something completely different and really positioned it in, you know, as a real contemporary drama. And also Black Mirror, the amazing production skill on those series as well. So it's not just the story, is it? It's actually the production expertise into realizing what on paper could look like something that's not particularly sellable, but the actual mastery of the producer to create such a show that takes it into somewhere else, really.
I wholly agree. And I think that touches on the continuing debate about creativity versus AI and all this. But my rather reductive and unintellectual approach to all of this is I still truly believe that you see brilliance on TV and people see, oh, that was a brilliant show, that was an amazing show, that on paper people wouldn't necessarily think that's a brilliant idea, or maybe they do, but it's all about that execution. And then suddenly people are like, well, of course it's brilliant. But the way these shows are produced and executed, there's a huge difference of what makes a good show and a bad show. And I mean, people often ask me, go, what are the current trends? And I refuse to always answer that question, because I say, but you can't ask what a current trend is, because number one, if you start chasing a trend now, you're going to be 2 years too late anyway. But it's always after the fact that someone goes, oh, well, that's a brilliant idea. It's that excellence of what's delivered. You're always introducing new, fresh ideas to people. And not everything catches, but when it does, it really catches. And I just don't think you can make that magic in a bottle without that individual brilliance that you have in all these production companies and the creators and the executive producers and the producers and the line producers and the camera, and then in the editing suites with the music. I mean, you're right about, I mean, that's been always the brilliance on those shows with Steve Knight. I mean, we'll come on to it a bit later on, but we're taking his next show to Cannes, This Town, which is set in the 1980s with a backdrop of the IRA and the troubles in the UK in the early 80s with the IRA and the backdrop of the ska music scene. And it's just this pounding soundtrack against families and relationships and the troubles. It propels these shows along. And I think, you know, Steve's brilliant at that, of just listening to the soundtracks in his head as he creates these shows. But yeah, it's about that elevation that us mortals sort of watch them eventually go, oh, wow, that was amazing. But we wouldn't be able to do it ourselves. And I always just think that is why we still need all these creatives to make these shows. I disagree with AI being the future and all of that, because in technology, fine. But that lightning in a bottle only happens every now and then. And it happens by accident or maybe by braveness. And if everything's done by an algorithm, I don't think you'll have that.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed my chat with Amelia Hartley, actually, who was a music supervisor. I think that was the correct title on that show.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and I had a really great conversation for a previous episode of Telecast on that particular show. So you mentioned what you're taking to MIPCOM. Tell us about what your key focus is for the market then. You know, what are your key titles that you're taking to Cannes? Presumably, it's one of your most important weeks of the year.
It's the biggest TV market, no question. And therefore, it's very important from a global perspective of all of those buyers and distributors and producers all meeting in one place. No question about that. It's vital. And it's vital for us as a company internally as well, because it's a bringing together of all of our companies as well. So it acts as a great conduit to conversation and creative discussions and just bringing everybody together as a company as well. So it works on two levels for us, for sure. And actually, even for me, my team is based in all those countries I mentioned earlier on. So it's a time I spend with my team actually face to face as well, which is, you know, obviously I see them at different times of the year, but I'm not with them day to day. So it's also another important one for that. But in terms of content, yeah, we always, always strive to have a strong lineup at MIPCOM. I mean, we are launching shows all year round and timings are different. But yes, it's a very important market for us. For us, it's scripted, it's unscripted, and of course, it's the format business as well, which for our producers and the people who handle the format. So just a very quick sort of rundown for us. It's This Town, as I've mentioned, with Steve Knight, the Steve Knight drama starring Michelle Dockery and Nicholas Pinnock. So that is a big launch for us. Three Little Birds, written by Lenny Henry, which launches on ITV and BritBox in the coming months. That's the story of three women who moved from Jamaica to the UK in the late 1950s, sort of loosely based on Lenny Henry's mother's journey. So that's a really important drama for us. So we're very excited about bringing that one to the market as well. And then on non-English, we've got from the producers of Bronn and Beck, we've got Fallen, which is written by Camilla Algreen, who was one of the original writers of Bronn. We've got Merlin Hanko from Finland, Broccoliane from Shine France, River Pierdu from TF1. And then we've got dramas that are still very fresh, but we're sort of in action on them anyway. So they're not launches per se, but we've still got The Sixth Commandment, which recently launched on BBC. Marie Antoinette season 2 is now in production. Rogue Heroes season 2 is just wrapped. We've got Anonymous, The Rig on Amazon, Domino that's just wrapped on MGM Plus, future seasons of Beck. And then for us, the library is also very important. And we have a very, very interesting library in terms of content as well on drama. So we're still selling shows like Broadchurch and Spooks and The Fool and McLeod's Daughters. All of that's actually really important for us as well. And really important for our producers because it creates amazing royalties. So we've got new, current, past seasons. I'm very privileged to be able to work within a company with this sort of really eye-boggling amount of drama. And then on the sort of more factual side, which is an area which we're really focusing a lot on at the moment, we've got some amazing premium sort of docs coming up like Four Kings, which is through our producers Workerby in Manchester, which is the story of those four amazing boxers in the 90s in the UK. So, you know, the Nigel Benn, Chris Eubanks, Lennox Lewis, and that sort of world. So that's a really interesting one. And then we've got The Rise and Fall of Boris Johnson, which comes to Channel 4 soon, which I'm sure will get debates going on sofas and dare say make people a bit angry again about the politics in this country, which I won't comment on because I don't live here. The more sort of escapist with the likes of Eva Longoria and her search for Mexico and Stanley Tucci of his for Italy, those beautiful shows of cooking and travel. And then the more rock and roll, we're working with the Osbournes, doing a reality show with the Osbournes, Home to Roost, as they move back to the UK in the coming months. So we're doing that one. And then crime with the other Mrs. Jordan and Lara versus Escobar, which is, you know, fascinating true crime miniseries or one-offs we're doing. So a real mix of all of that. And then behind all of that, there's just hundreds of shows from like Ambulance and 999. And, you know, I could go on forever. So a really interesting mix on that factual entertainment side as well. And then game shows and all of that. And then on the formats, you know, the big focus for the company is The Summit, which launched in Australia earlier this year, which there's going to be some announcements on that, which is, you know, a very big scale adventure format. Buddy Games, which has just launched on CBS, Bernard Murray one with Joe Giacomol, which again is another big show. Deal or No Deal Island, which again has been picked up in various big, big territories that's coming, banged up. And then don't forget, we are continuing to expand MasterChef, Survivor, Big Brother, Star Academy, Deal or No Deal. So we could do a whole podcast on content we've got, really. So that's just a bit of a smorgasbord of what's happening next week.
Now it's time for Story of the Week, the part of the show where my guests get to nominate their key TV industry story that's caught their eye in the past 7 days. Matt, what's your story of the week?
Well, actually, travelling back over to the UK and reading a lot of press, it was actually a story in the Financial Times, which was, you know, it's not the trade press one, which was a very interesting one, just of an analysis of where the US studio business is and how tech sort of infiltrated back in the early 2010s. And now we're really seeing how tech has kind of really got a firm footprint in the, what is the traditional systems of the US entertainment industry and what the impacts are of that with private equity and the growth of debt, cost cutting, and how that impacts business going on. So that caught my eye because it impacts obviously our business across the board. But in terms of the co-production business, which I oversee there, you know, we have seen that the impact on a positive level over the years of how that was real expansion into the SVOD space and there's a drove for subscribers with this drive for content. And now how we're seeing a real correction in that market because they move from subscribers to profit. And therefore, with that, costs and a retraction in content and the challenges that that brings. So it was a very enlightening article. Nothing I didn't know, maybe reinforced slight anxiety and trepidation in my day-to-day, but I have to remain optimistic that things will settle again and then will a new normal will then occur again in the future. But it's certainly been in the US a tumultuous 18 months, and I thought that encapsulated it very well.
And building on that, do you think that the S-Fords, who used to take global rights, with those challenges that they have got and all sorts of global challenges when it comes to cost of living and the way that profit is becoming much more important for them, do you think that's going to have a result when it comes to co-productions? Do you think there's going to be co-productions and distribution, international distribution is going to be much more important, almost like it was pre-COVID? Do you think that there's going to be more of a call and more international sales and less global rights being taken by the S-Fords?
Yeah, and I think in general that the S-Fods have been shifting that way anyway, because Netflix is the best example. That model of co-pro was to get really started for them, but they were always heading for an original model, and that's where they're at. So I think for now, they're focused on the originals and the co-pro things slipped away slightly. It's interesting. It's come sort of full circle, and I'll focus maybe more specifically on the US, because I think, yes, there's definitely less global deals. There still will be global deals, but still less. So I think I'll focus on the US because that's so key for co-productions in general for English-speaking drama. But what we had in the US maybe around, you know, the mid-2010s up until maybe just after COVID was this drive for content that was needed by certainly the S-Fords, and actually to a degree maybe a bit on linear as well, where the volume of originals that was being created was very high and costs for these services was very high in getting those produced as well. So the model of the co-producer, i.e. a company like us coming in and going, well, look, we've got this great show and that we've already got picked up by the BBC and we're looking for a partner. They really liked that model of coming in because it ticked a lot of boxes for them straight away, because it gave them the comfort of knowing, A, the producer was a very strong producer, and B, the partner in the UK was a very strong partner. So it gave them editorial comfort that they knew, okay, this is going to be a certain level. So they could bring these shows in and they could wrap them up as an original. So to the viewer and the subscriber, they wouldn't know. They're just like, wow, another original show, isn't that great? So they took more risks because of that, because it was, to them, wasn't the same price as an original. So they took a lot of risks on shows. And certainly as these services were launching, like Max and Peacock and places like that, they took risks. In the world we're in now, that has retracted for now. They don't want to take those risks. Budgets have been squeezed and there's been a retraction on coming in on co-productions for sure. If you take a show out this year, the pitches you would get has definitely lessened to what you would have got 18 months ago, for example. What I think will happen again, and we're beginning to see seeds of it, is maybe some other platforms there, someone like Showtime, for example, or someone like Stars, who are having to cut back on their originals, are looking again at maybe at that model of where can we come in on shows early that we can dress up as an original, but it's actually a co-production. So I see it going sort of full evolution again, that we might in 2024 and 2025, we'll see more of those opportunities. But at the moment, it's certainly challenged because there's just been retraction full stop in terms of people coming in early and in a material way on the volume of shows that are coming out of the UK. And there's a lot of shows coming out of the UK, for example. Not everything can get sold. So it's challenging. There's been, you know, we've all benefited from that sort of content appetite there's been in the last 5 or 6 years. And there's just been a bit of a correction in the market. And that's where we are at the moment.
And now it's time for Matt's Hero of the Week. Matt, who is your Hero of the Week?
Well, I'm going to cheat slightly. I've got a team of the week, and it's been my team since I was in my mid-teens. So I'm a Newcastle United supporter. Exactly a week ago, you've given me a week, so exactly a week ago, Newcastle at St James's Park blew PSG off the field, and that's the first time in 20 plus years they've had Champions League football at St James's Park. It was a joy to behold, having had the utter depressive misery of the last 20 years of Newcastle. That was a crowning moment. They were my heroes of the week.
I like the way you qualified that you've been a Newcastle United fan for all your life there, Matt, before you answered. That was
I'm 51 and I'm going to claim that, and everyone who knows me will claim it. But I know the problem is when you get bought by a rich, well, by the Saudis, it becomes a, oh, you've just jumped on the bandwagon. I would like to have this recorded forever that I have gone through a lot of misery with Newcastle, as many people will attest to.
Okay, well, just quickly on that, do you consider yourself one of the top six now?
Actually, I think this season it becomes a top eight. So I consider it as a top eight.
All right, okay. That's a very diplomatic answer. And who or what are you telling to get in the bin?
Yeah, I thought about this, and you know, obviously events this week have sort of taken a serious turn around the world. So I'm not going to talk about that because I don't feel it's really my place to. So, but I will touch on a touch of American politics, if I may, because I'm American citizen, so I do vote as well. But I despair at the extremists led by Matt Gaetz in the House in America, and just how this minority of disruptors and the loudest people in the room who seem to be eroding democracy on a day-to-day basis in America and have a ridiculous amount of power for being pretty untalented people. So Matt Gaetz would be my villain of the week just because of the utter turmoil that continues in the US government that he seems to revel in, and I would argue revels in for his own benefit as opposed to the people in his district that he's supposed to represent. So that is my views, if you wanted a villain of the week.
Yeah, and US election next year, isn't it?
Ugh, I mean, just the anxiety levels raise on a daily level.
Yeah, you know, the repercussions it has all over the world makes everybody else tune into that as well. Matt, thank you so much for joining me this week. Really interesting chat to hear about what's going on at Banerjee and everything else that's going on with your role. Good luck for everything at MIPCOM. I think it's going to be sunny, certainly at the weekend it is. So hope to see you there on a very sunny Quasset.
Thanks so much. I've really enjoyed it. Actually, I'm a big fan of podcasts and listening to them, and I've really enjoyed being on this one. So thanks so much for inviting me on.
Not at all. And I'll see you in Cannes for a glass of rosé.
Great, perfect. Thanks so much.
So it's about 85 degrees in Rome. We're in the Palazzo Barbieri, and you can hear the hum of the traffic and lots of Italian TV industry execs here at MIA. I'm here with Bea Hegedus, Executive Managing Director of Vice Distribution. Bea, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Justin.
Thank you for agreeing to have a chat with me. Ahead of our panel, we've got a panel happening Thursday, which is tomorrow, which is all about digital content and all the amazing development that's going on in that sector. But we're going to have a talk about Vice, and we're going to be talking about Vice Distribution and you and what you've been up to and what the future is for Vice, which is a really exciting talking point. So let's start by a bit about you, because you've been in the international TV industry, seen at markets and events all over the world. So just give us a recap of your career to date.
Yes, so my entire career has been in television. Early on, I was a producer. A TV producer. So I started in the game show business, produced lots of game shows, then started working on scripted shows. Then I got bitten by the distribution bug. Somebody asked me if I was interested in selling some of the shows that I was making internationally. And then I thought, how hard could that be? Every time we create an idea, we need to pitch it to somebody. I might as well pitch it to different cultures around the world. And I just managed to love it, managed to do really well and loved it. So I stayed in the distribution business for quite a while now, always bouncing between scripted and unscripted, worked for Fox, ran distribution in international business for Lionsgate, Denmark, Mercury, and just started Vice Distribution about 3 years ago. Because when at the time Kate Ward came to me, she said, you know, we make all this creative, really crazy, amazing content. Vice has a very strong brand, but we don't really look outside of the Vice ecosystem. And all we do all day long is putting our amazing content onto our platforms, which is great, which is what created this powerhouse for us. But at the same time, maybe it's a good idea to look outside and see if we can have partners and we can work with partners and create content with more of an outward-facing mentality. We actually had a division by studios that was already doing that. They were doing elevated content for Netflix and Amazon for a while. They did the Fire documentary that everyone knows on Netflix, which was a cult hit at the time, and the report with Adam Driver. And so everything they touched was really exciting, high-end stuff with a different kind of flavor than the general distributors or like producers would do. So we set out on this journey, and when Nancy took the company over from Shane, to start making content for the international marketplace, for other platforms in the US. And that's what we've been doing ever since then. And Vice Distribution is finding a home, trying to find partnerships, trying to find funding for all those creative and amazing stuff that our producers are making within the group.
So there's obviously been some big changes at Vice recently, which I realize you can't talk too much about that. Perhaps my take on that is, you know, part of the result of that is being such a challenging and leading business that has been really leading the whole digital content revolution by extraordinary journalism over the years, still trying to find business models that work. Tell us about Vice now. Give us an idea of what the Vice group looks like, what are its constituent parts?
Yes, so Vice is the original MCN. We are digital natives, which is our strength. By our DNA, we are used to innovating and always looking for new opportunities, new ways of making content, doing business. So this is not something that really shakes us to the core. Change is what we live in. We've always lived in change, and we are always, we say that we are there before everyone else is there. So for us, a bit of turbulence, like a couple of like this year was a bit turbulent, is something that we just draw strength from. And not many people understand what our recent challenges were. They were not the challenges that sometimes people think they were. It was just a simple restructuring of finances within the group. But a lot of parts of the group, they have been operating and are operating as usual, as normal. We have a new owner, which always brings new possibilities and, you know, excitement in investing into content, dialing up on what we've been doing really well, and maybe shedding some of the stuff where we feel we shouldn't be, you know, playing. But generally, the new owners really want to supersize this business. They are behind us creating more content. And that's what we are trying to figure out now, what that would look like. But it will be always following our DNA. We will have our digital teams, our news teams and TV teams working together more than ever before, together with studios, with the elevated content and Pulse. It will maybe require a bit more collaboration between us. So you will see more of our content coming from one line of business of digital, going to TV, going across to other areas, which is what we've been actually trying to do for the past couple of years, maximizing revenue. That's why I also started the FAST business within Vice in 2020, late 2020, early 21, because that's another space that we understand and we should be heavily leaning into. And I think with the acquisition that's been, well, I know that it's earmarked as a growth area for us, and we are going to focus on that more and more. But all the other businesses are also healthy and will continue operating as usual. What we do best is extraordinary journalism, like you said, so that's correct. And so everything we do has a journalistic point of view, or like an investigative point of view. What we do really well as well is that while you are looking at reporting around the world on news or investigative journalism. You don't see a diverse team like Vice. I love watching some of our news programming because Krishna or Larzo, they all look like everyone else around us in the UK, in the US, everywhere. So we are very diverse, the most diverse team, I would say, in news. And that also brings about an extraordinary depth to our reporting, which I'm really proud of. And I really hope that we can, you know, continue with that and use those teams for other things within the group as well. Because I think cross-collaboration is what's going to elevate Vice even more than before. And we've had a lot of success with sending programming from digital into television, and, you know, or like an idea that started with a different team ending up with the news teams, ending up with studios teams. So that's what you're going to be seeing a lot more of happening within the group. And hopefully we will be also leading in this way and showing others how to do certain things.
So is it going to be more of a refocus almost back onto the original DNA of the Vice brand? Because Vice has become known for, as you say, challenging journalism, but also giving an alternative point of view. And we're now in a sort of post-truth world where everyone's looking for different sources of reliable information, and there's more and more, let's say, cynicism around some of the traditional news brands out there. Is this change in the organization, do you think it's going to be a refocusing? Am I right in my assumption of that as being your DNA?
I mean, we are trying to follow our audience. So that's our main priority. So wherever our audience goes, we are going. I think it's what we are doing now is trying to see all these different divisions as equally important. Early Vice was maybe very heavily digital. Recently, we were trying to lean more into TV. I think what we're going to see is a calibration of all of these divisions are equally important. And my main focus as distribution is, where is our audience? And that's where we are focusing. And our audience is digitally native. So where is the digitally native audience going? Is that fast? How much of that is on television? How much of that is on YouTube? So that's the big work we have to do now. That's what keeps me awake every night. Like, what's next? Where am I seeing the right return for the investment that we are making? And it's not as simple as maybe we thought 2 years ago it was. It's a lot more complex. And I think focus will be on partnerships as well, the right partnerships, and fast. Fast is definitely a big focus for us. Yeah.
Okay, so you talked about that being an area that you've led within the business over the last couple of years. So you've seen meaningful revenues coming through fast?
Yes, definitely. So my revenues in fast are predicted to overtake the distribution revenue very soon. It's already a significant amount. And that's without us really diving into the details of it, because we also have a very talented ad sales team. So we are going to look at where everyone is already looking at selling our own ads on the platforms and all that. So I can see a world where this is going to overtake our traditional distribution business revenues, if we are smart enough to execute on certain details, and if we are very good at following our audience and how they approach it. I always say an analogy, this is kind of a bit controversial maybe. Our audience has a smart television. They know how to switch it on. They know how to find an app. And they know how to find a channel within that app. They are not the audience who has an old-fashioned television and they can switch it on and switch it off. So we just need to follow that audience and where they are going and what they are watching. And then we're going to be extremely successful.
So you mentioned YouTube. Is that still a key distribution pipeline for Vice News and other Vice content? Is that growing? Is that building? Or is that, you know, how does that sit within the ecosystem? Because we'll come on to talk about some of the feature docs that you've been producing and that have been really successful recently. Tell us a little bit about YouTube and publishing direct to social. How's that working out?
In digital, we are doing exactly what we were doing in the past. You know, we have a big YouTube audience. We have big social media followers. People come to Vice, the brand, for a certain flavor. So we have to continue giving them that flavor, otherwise they stop coming. So we are still creating all that stuff. What we are trying to do is sending it around more in within the different divisions. So we have a great idea. We have many ideas that started with digital and then they ended up on television. Our Andrew Tate documentary that was seen on the BBC's, well, it was on BBC Three and it's on the iPlayer, that started with a producer who was working in the digital news teams. And he's been researching this topic for a long time and he was making this program for a long time while preparing for it and making it way before Andrew Tate was arrested. And it became a groundbreaking documentary that was the first to market when he was arrested. We also have shows like The Story Of, which is very popular on YouTube. It's a music documentary, half-hour music documentary, where we have access, full access to the stars. And they talk about their own song and how it almost wasn't made or almost was killed very early on by studio executives, as it happened. And it's a very popular title that's requested around the world by, you know, partners, so we sell it. But also it went on Vice TV because it crossed over from digital to Vice TV and back. So we are making more episodes on digital. We made another season for Vice TV and it worked really well. We also have another title that started on digital and there is a different version of it in digital called One Star Reviews that also was made for television in a TV format. Between these line of businesses, we send content around and teams are cross-creating content. The studios business is a bit of a different business because I would say the studios business strength is that, you know, we have all these amazing talent like Beyoncé and Sean Penn who come to us for trying to make a documentary. And then the studios team can execute beautifully. And studios now has Pulse as part of it, can execute beautifully on that promise. So that's how we ended up with Superpower, which is the documentary that Sean Penn did with Zelensky. And we did Beyoncé's Lemonade, whilst Pulse did it. So all this amazing talent comes to us when they want to express something and they want to create a piece of content that they are proud of. And they feel that we are the right partner. Studios is the absolute right partner for that, and that speaks to the strength of our brand and our sensibilities, and they execute on a really, really high budget and high end. And obviously Pulse is Gangs of London is just a beast. it won't ever stop. It's wildly successful. So that's what we are really working with, that we are trying to be a place where you come for the brand and for how our content feels like, rather than what budget levels we are working with. We are working on every budget level and we're going to be working with every budget level all the time. It's more about anywhere, a good idea can come from anywhere. It can come from studios, it can come from digital, it can come from the TV development teams. And then we are trying to find, I am in distribution, trying to find partners, like-minded partners, who would like to work with us and who want to create content with the same sensibility that would work for them. We have a very successful partnership with SBS in Australia. We run SBS Viceland in Australia while they run it for us. And they have all of our content and we are collaborating on so many projects. And we have a deal with Tubi for originals. Specifically, the news team is creating investigative documentaries for Tubi that they love and hopefully will continue for a long time. A good idea can come from anywhere. And the digital guys are as important as the studio teams.
So let's talk about that for a second. So the development process then, how does that work? Because we've talked on Telecast before about this thing, it's been termed the octopus strategy, where there's a sort of central idea that could be made into a short, it could be mid-form, could be long-form, could be feature doc, could be various different ways of telling that one single story. How does the development process work within Vice? Who brings the story in, and how does that get discussed, and how does the content strategy for that story work?
Well, each team's within Vice. Maybe I should talk about the different divisions within Vice first. So obviously Vice is an award-winning company with five main line of businesses. So we have an ad agency, Virtue. We have Vice Studios with Pulse. It's our premium studio. Vice TV, Vice News, that just won 9 Emmys, news Emmys. Recently, they always win a lot of Emmys. And then we have distribution. And then these businesses all have development teams working for their audience. They know their audience really well. The digital teams know they're creating for YouTube, social media. They know their audience. The TV teams are creating for, obviously, television. But we have a central green light meeting where everybody brings their ideas and we green light it together. And then sometimes at that green light meeting, we talk about, oh, whether this should be something else. And it happened that before that we thought about, oh, maybe this news idea should go on Vice TV instead of selling it externally or putting it on YouTube, Vice News YouTube channel. Or studio teams were developing something and the news teams thought that they could work together on that. So it's very important that I think the green light meeting is a very good place to share ideas, formed ideas. I also personally have individual meetings with the line of businesses where I give feedback to them about where I see potential internationally and whether we should be making this program, whether I could find a partner early on, co-production partner. And it happened before that I would say, you know, I don't think this would sell very well internationally. It's very US focused and sometimes those ideas don't get made. So we are trying to listen to each other a lot more than in the past. That's a muscle we have to work on more and more, but we need to listen to each other because the ideal word for me is that, you know, we have a great idea that starts somewhere within the group and I find the first window somewhere in the US for it. I can sell it internationally. I can put it on my FAST channel afterwards. Maybe send it to an AVOD platform first and then to my FAST channel and then send it back to digital. Put it on YouTube, which we do a lot of already. But I would love to get that muscle going a lot more.
There's going to be more focus on your remit going forward when it comes to commercial exploitation and really being focused on, you know, what stories are going to be placed where. And as you said, more and more commercial partnerships than perhaps we've seen in the past.
Yes. And I think Vice has that special flavor. So in every country, you will find one. It's not like I can go to every one or two partner that would fit our sensibilities. So my job has always been to find that partner in each and every country that would benefit from our audience, who is trying to target the same audience and likes our flavor. And, you know, we had a very successful partnership when All Four started. We started together with All Four, Channel 4 in the UK. We started with an entire library. We uploaded it. We were in a branded area and Channel 4 was very pleased with the audience that came via Vice to O4. And even though we restructure that deal because they because their strategy changed, and now we just have crime series with them. We were there initially, one of their main brand partners, where we played a big role in their discoverability. So I'm in every country I go and have discussions, you know, I'm always asking clients whether they are interested in getting my audience. Because with Vice comes the audience. If you play it right, you know, we can bring a giant audience. We have 350 million people watching Vice around the world on all platforms. And that's a big audience. And that's what we are trying to do with Fast as well, to move some of that. Many of those people are watching us on social media. And they don't have traditional TV anymore. How you send them back to your Fast channel or... That's what our job is to find out.
Yeah, that's the challenge. So finally, we're in the run-up to MIPCOM. Now, I know you're not going to be there because you're flying back from Rome to LA and you've got various other meetings in the States going on. What can buyers and delegates at MIPCOM expect to see from the Vice distribution team there?
Well, we are very excited about MIPCOM because this MIPCOM looks like it's going to be huge. Everybody will be there. I'm starting to have FOMO now. Seriously. I thought, it's okay. I have a good team. They can deal with it. But like, wow. Our main focus at MIPCOM will be finding those partners, obviously. So the team is, you know, in Asia, in Europe, talking to every country, basically trying to find people who would like to have a partnership with us long term. But we have a lot of cool titles that are coming through, traditional TV titles that are very successful. We have our Dark Side franchise that's just grown into this other space. You know, we have hundreds of hours of it now. We are taking, well, we have Dark Side of the Ring that we started with, and we have four seasons of that. We have Dark Side of Comedy, Dark Side of Football, and Dark Side of the 90s, Dark Side of 2000s. So we are making a lot of Dark Sides. So that's definitely a mainstay of our catalog that we've always been, and the team has been very active selling. And we have a lot of crime coming to MIPCOM. We have Resolved, which is a Vice take on an investigative crime series where internet sleuths and professional investigators are reinvestigating some of Hollywood's most famous murders. A bit speculative, a bit serious, very Vice, very entertaining crime series. We also have, the news teams created a really great title for Tubi about Ticketmaster and the scandal around those crazy people who, the scam that was created by buying a Bordeaux ticket and then reselling it and what's behind it. So they really dive into that and really unpack what's behind that. And then we have a lot of good new developments coming to MIPCOM that we are working on, and some of them will be announced just before MIPCOM, so I'm not going to tell you yet. That Vice TV commissioned, and they are, you know, they have always, during this year, they've always were outside of the bankruptcy stuff because it's a JV with A&E. They've been commissioning shows all through the year. So they have a lot of development that they are just there green lighting, and they're going to be talking about at MIPCOM that we are kind of pre-selling. The team is pre-selling. We are just going to talk to a lot of our Fast partners as well, whoever comes. I mean, I was in LA 2 weeks ago at the Amagi Fast conference, so I talked to a lot of our Fast partners. But we are looking at how it could look like if we launch these Fast channels, because currently we are only live in the US. How would it look like if we launch them in the UK? Because I think there is a need, there is a... Even though the monetization is not the same yet, but there is a need definitely for something like Vice that looks like TV and feels like Vice, as we say. So they're going to be talking to European partners as well, with the potential of expanding the Fast business into Europe and beyond. Yeah, so it's going to be very busy for them.
Yeah. and you're going to be on a plane to LA with FOMO. Bea, thank you so much for spending some time with us. It's really great to catch up with you. And sounds like you're going to have a busy year ahead and ways of forging new partnerships and building new revenue streams within the business. So good luck with all of that.
Yes, thank you, Justin. And, you know, hopefully a lot more content is going to come out of Vice next year. We have a lot of great development. I'm just working through how to get them greenlit, and we are off to the races very soon.
All right. And we'll also see you as part of the Telecast Digital Content Forum on November the 9th at the BFI South Bank. So look forward to seeing you there.
Yes, see you there.
Well, time's up on this week's show. As always, thanks a lot for listening. If you're in Rome for Mia this week, be sure to check out the Telecast panel at midday on Thursday the 12th of October. And if you're not, we'll be recording the session with a stellar lineup of digital-first executives and putting that out on a future episode. And Telecast will be out on the ground at MIPCOM with a film crew shooting short-form chats with the movers and shakers on La Croisette. So, subscribe to Telecast on YouTube and follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram and TikTok for all the latest bite-sized news from the market. Telecast was edited by Ian Chambers and recorded in Rome. We'll see you next week in CAP. Until then, stay safe.